Welcome back to another episode of What the HR, an award-winning podcast. I'm Jesse Novi.
And I'm Mike Toole. The What the HR podcast explores how to build people-centric businesses through modern practices and approaches. New episodes are released frequently, so don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss any episodes.
Welcome back to another episode of What the HR. Today, we're lucky enough to be joined by Angela Christman, who is the founder and CEO of Lift Bridge Strategy. She's also a former senior leader focused on helping companies grow through modern common sense approaches to getting and retaining people. She started her career co-leading HR for a small social services company and later spent 15 years leading teams for two great brands, Walmart and Marvin. Angela understands how work gets done in small companies, Fortune 1, and somewhere in between. She is known for being thoughtful and collaborative, thinking outside of the silo of the traditional HR function to understand and make an impact in the broader business. So with our time with Angela today, we specifically talked about human-centered design. If you have not heard of this term before, we talk about what it is and really why you should care about it. Human-centered design really is a way for organizations to transform their business by putting their teams and frankly even their customers at the center of their strategy, delivering people-centered business outcomes every day. So this was a really fun episode. I honestly could have chatted with Angela about this way beyond the time that we had allotted. There's just so much to cover in this great space, but I feel like we did a nice job giving a nice high-level overview in addition to also getting in the weeds a little bit so that you can walk away from this episode hopefully feeling inspired and maybe even with a few little nuggets that you can take back to your team or to other business leaders that you partner with in your role. So as always, if you are enjoying our podcast episodes and our guests, please do us a huge favor. Head on over to your favorite podcast platform. Leave us both a rating and a review. The combination of both of those things really helps to ensure that our episodes are getting out in front of other business leaders and HR professionals. And as always, we really appreciate you being a listener of the podcast and enjoy the episode. All right. Well, Angela, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited for the conversation. This will be fun.
Yeah, we are too. We haven't talked about human-centered design before. So to give our listeners a little bit of a sneak peek into the topic that we're going to be covering with Angela today. But before we get into the meat of things, if you could give our listeners just a little bit of a background on yourself and how you ended up in this space.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'd love to. Well, first of all, I won't go too far back, but my fascination with people at work starts as a child, actually. I grew up in a family business, and so people at work were the conversation around the dinner table every night. And that's really what led to me pursuing a career in HR. And I led HR teams for almost 20 years, primarily between Walmart and Marvin, two great brands and many great experiences, great teams. And the way that I got into applying human-centered design in HR really started during my time at Walmart. My last role that I held there was leading talent and performance management for their e-com and tech business. And we started talking a lot about the concept of minimum viable product, or MVP. And we talked about it implied in HR in the context of the fact that lots of times in HR, we want to make everything perfect, right? So we really just want whatever we roll out to the organization to check all the boxes. We want people to be happy and to see really effective programs come to life. Well, the thing is that sometimes that just takes too long. And often if we thought about it more in the sense of an MVP, we would get further faster. So let me give you an example. So when you're building a car, think of this like final end product that's perfect, like the Tesla, right? That's your car. As you're building a car along the way, when you start out, you have kind of the base frame and the wheels, and that's maybe like a skateboard. And then you add the steering wheel and you have more of a scooter. And then you add the frame and you have a dune buggy. And then finally you have the fully built car. Well, as I said, so many times we want to offer the fully built car. And if we just offered the business the scooter or the skateboard at the outset, we could have added immediate value. And lots of times when we wait until we have this perfect car, it turns out that by the time that happens, that's no longer the right solution anymore anyway. And so this concept of moving really fast, adding value to the business quickly, learning from mistakes really, really resonated with me and got me sort of hooked. And then from Walmart, I went to Marvin, where I started out leading a talent team. And at the time, Marvin was on a journey to implement human-centered design as it related to their product innovation. And we started applying human-centered design in HR as well, specifically related to talent and culture work. And that's where I learned a lot more about the process and just the importance of always keeping the user at the center. And the user in our case, meaning the talent, right? Whether it's an employee, a team member, a candidate, but always designing around that user.
That's great. So I think you kind of gave a little bit of a preview to those that have not heard of this term human-centered design before through your examples. But if they didn't pick up on it, or if you were in an elevator and had to give your little elevator speech on like, well, what in the heck is human-centered design? How would you wrap it up?
It's a method of innovation that really involves keeping whoever your user is, a customer, an employee, a candidate for a job, at the center of what you're designing. And people might say, well, what in the heck does that mean? And I'll explain a little bit more. What it means is that so many times we start out when we need something new, when we're solving a business problem, and we say, okay, it's taking too long to hire people. Let's give that as an example, right? Our hiring process just takes too long. We'll take a group of people into a room, we'll do a little whiteboarding, and we'll hammer out what we think is a fabulous new hiring process that will take less time, right? And then we go and roll that out to the organization. What we haven't considered when we do that is, what is the experience for everyone involved? And what does that actually feel like on the other side? So what if instead of saying, let's go hammer out a new process and go into a room and whiteboard for a while, what if we went and gathered feedback from candidates and from hiring managers, from recruiters, interviewed people along the way around the process to really understand from their perspective what's going well and what's not going well, and to observe the process maybe in some cases. By building a better experience for all of those folks, we'll achieve the same outcome of more efficiency, in fact, a better outcome with more efficiency, many would say, than we would by just going into a room and whiteboarding. So that's what user at the center really means, is designing around the experience of that end user rather than designing around a process or what we think the best solution might be. You know, a lot of people might recognize, especially if you work a lot in the change management space, this sounds a lot like change management methodology, where you involve people along the way, right? And we want to talk to people and gather their feedback and co-create. And that's not accidental either. Human-centered design is actually a really helpful tool for navigating change as well.
And because our listeners are in all sorts of different roles within HR, this philosophy or framework applies to every team or group or COE that you might be a part of in HR.
Absolutely. And the more that I think about the role that HR people play today versus the role that we maybe used to play in the past, I think about the ways that we advise the business as well, right? And how many times does the business do applied to the customer what I just described to you applied to the candidate experience? So it can be really good for us as HR partners to also be asking the business questions like, what's the customer input that's driving that decision? Or what's the customer experience going to be like as you implement that decision? Or, you know, because being people-centered or human-centered, we apply it in HR to a talent base, but it also very much applies, sort of originates in the customer space, right? And how can we be that good business partner and really drive both?
So would you say, when you say people-centered experiences, is that opposed to like a process-centered way
Absolutely.
Of doing things? Like, is that kind of what, can you kind of explain a little bit more? Like, it's, that's how I understood. Am I understanding that correctly?
Absolutely. You are. And one of my favorite examples in the HR space related to this difference is the experience related to taking a leave of absence. So lots of times we think of taking a leave of absence as a process to be designed, right? So we know that there are certain regs and rules around what paperwork goes out when and what people have to complete and what the timing is for the different things that we send them, what notification. A lot of times what people aren't thinking about when it comes to processes like that is that a leave of absence, when someone's taking a leave, it's usually an experience for them, a very personal thing that's either a best experience of their life or a worst experience of their life. And if we were to design the way that people move through the leave of absence process for a company around the end user, the person who's taking the leave, how would that process look different? And what sorts of things might we do differently if we were to look at it through their eyes rather than through the eyes of the paperwork and the this needs to be done by when? And that's actually one of my favorite examples.
So another example that I can think of is like, if I think of the application from a candidate perspective versus application from a recruiting perspective, you know, is that a good use case? I think about it like from an applicant perspective or a candidate, you got to fill out all of this information. It just seems like a lot of work done, and it feels as though maybe you're doing that work to make somebody else's life easier on the back end. Can you talk a little bit more about, because you had mentioned, it seems like we're focused on keeping bad applicants out versus making it easy for good talent to get hired.
That's exactly right. I'm so glad you brought that up, Mike. So if you go and look at your hiring process, everything from when a candidate first becomes aware of your company and goes to fill out an application and goes through the interview process, is that process built around whether the candidate is making a decision to join your company or whether your company is making a decision to hire that candidate or both? And is that process designed around keeping poor candidates out or making it really easy for great candidates to get through the process and get hired quickly? And I think many times we run into this scenario where the process is really designed around the company and not around the candidate. So one example would be all of the conversation that we're seeing recently and, you know, over the last few years, really around these video interviews, right? Where a candidate completes a video interview where they just record it. Where is the opportunity in that process for a candidate to ask their questions and to get answers about the company that they might have, right? And there might be scenarios where that seems like the right thing for a candidate. We always say there's no one size fits all, right? That's a key component of this too. But generally, that feels like a pretty company-centric experience, right? We're going to watch a video of you. You don't really have a chance to answer questions about us. So those types of examples. And then the things that you're asking on applications and just even practically speaking, how long does it take to complete it? Some of those types of things. Is the application designed around and is the entire process designed around keeping poor candidates out versus making it easy for good ones to get in?
Yeah, I mean, the video recording is almost, I mean, unless the role is specific to people that are very good in front of a video and creating content, it doesn't really apply to the role that they're probably going for. So when you talk about making things easier for everybody, an MVP, like is, across the board, is that from a company perspective, is that in process changes across every department? We're talking about HR a little bit here, but I mean, it seems like something that would resonate across the board, not just in one area.
Absolutely. I think it comes up a lot. This idea of experience before process comes up a lot in the customer space too. So if you think about areas like customer success or how easy it is for a customer to even buy your product, for example, or to get service related to your product. Are those experiences for customers designed around the idea that we're trying to make the experience better for customers, or are they designed around making sure that the company saves money? And there are certainly, we all recognize that there are pragmatic reasons why you might have certain gates in effect and such, but we've also all experienced scenarios when we've received service in a retail store, for example, where it felt like team members were not empowered to make really, really basic customer service decisions. And those are examples, or anytime someone's referencing a policy rather than a value or a core reason why something is important, that's a red flag that they don't really understand why, right? Whether it's related to employee situations, customer situations, whatever, people tend to use policies as their go-to when they don't really understand why. And that's one of the drivers of a really poor experience, right? Is people not understanding the why or having decisions that are rooted in values ultimately.
So, you know, based on human-centered design, like what are some of the kind of foundational principles or kind of strategies to implement a human-centered design?
So the first one is to recognize that there is no one size fits all. And that people are different and have different needs, and that we shouldn't make assumptions of what those needs are. So a lot of human-centered design, the process itself is rooted in kind of a research methodology where you start by first making sure that you've defined the problem that you're trying to solve really, really clearly. That is the first step, is making sure that you have a really clear understanding of what you're solving for. And we all try to do that in our jobs every day. But when you think about how you frame up the challenge, framing it as how might we improve our selection process? How might we empower frontline customer success employees to make decisions for customers? When you frame it in a positive way of how might we solve this challenge, it starts to lend to more ideation and innovation in the process. The next thing that you do is you start by thinking about, okay, so now we've defined the problem. What's the research that we need to do to really understand the problem and to also sort of initiate the ideation process? So for example, when we're using human-centered design, we talk about looking in and looking out. So looking in would be, we want to improve our hiring process. Let's conduct interviews with candidates and hiring leaders and recent hires, recruiters, yada, 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 right? Let's conduct interviews and understand. The looking out part of that that's really critical is to go and research what are other companies doing? Who has the best hiring process? And I always encourage people to, I think we have a tendency when we're benchmarking, if you will, to want to look at companies in like industries to ours. We want to say, what are other retailers doing? What are other manufacturers doing? Look at an industry that's completely divergent from your industry. And see what inspiration you can take. It doesn't mean, I think we're always looking for what's a like scenario that we could bring back and implement. But part of this process is actually looking for inspiration as you go through. It doesn't mean that you will come back and implement everything you've learned in your context, but it is likely to inspire and spark new ideas, which is why the next phase is ideation. And you do a lot of activities like brainstorming and things like that in the ideation phase. And there are all sorts of folks who really, really specialize deeply in this space that have many different exercises for ideation. And then you get to design. And one of the key things that I would call out about design is it's really a test and learn. It's a prototyping. It's the idea of the skateboard and the scooter rather than the car, right? And then you're just continuously iterating and learning. But you might think of a prototype as let's take something really simple and implement it with a small group and get their reaction. What might this like? It doesn't mean that you need to pilot it with 100 people. That can be the sort of stuff that slows us down. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's not important to do that, especially when you're making really big changes that impact lots of people's lives. But what are some smaller ways that you can test and learn and prototype along the way?
Do you have any examples of that? So you mentioned the car, and then it starts as a skateboard. We talked about minimum viable product. Can you give an example of that? Like, what, think of a change that maybe is a car, and then what would the skateboard be in that scenario? Just for myself and listeners, like trying to get some context around like what could the overall idea be, which is the car, versus what can we get started in making an impact quickly, which is a skateboard?
Yeah. Let's say that you've decided that you want to implement some sort of quarterly check-in process. Let's say that you want to, and I'm talking about performance management. Let's say that your organization has been on the traditional annual cycle for performance management. So let's talk about how you would go through the process and maybe test some things along the way. The first thing that you want to do is go and define, what are you really solving for? Do you want a better experience? Do you want something to be more efficient and a better experience? Is there, what's leading you to look at this, right? Is it people likely want more frequent feedback? How might we provide more frequent feedback? Let's say that that's it. Old way of doing it might be, we're going to go design a quarterly check-in. New way, how can we provide more frequent ongoing feedback to people? Interview leaders, interview employees. Really understand what the experience is like and what they need from the experience. Do your external research. Maybe what you land on for your skateboard is something where you just implement a simple quarterly check-in. Let's say you do land on a quarterly check-in, and maybe it's three questions that you land on that are most important based on what your user needs, rather than a big elaborate process. Well, you know, sometimes we get slowed down. How are we going to get it in the technology? How are we going to choose which group to test it in? How are we going to, what if you just simply asked a small group of people skateboard? What if you simply asked a couple of leaders who are early adopters and are really passionate about the topic? Here's a template. Go have these conversations with your teams this month and see how it goes and provide us feedback, rather than thinking, we have this new thing and we're going to pilot it with 100 people. Then you've got immediate feedback about how those check-ins went. What was the response to the feedback and the process? Did people like it? Did they not? What would you iterate? And then you gradually change it along the way and start testing with larger groups and those types of things.
Versus the car being, we have our three questions. How do we put this into our performance system? How do we build reports based on this? You know what I mean?
Yes. How do we follow up with the people who don't do it?
Yeah. Right? All that validation stuff is kind of the car at the end. And that makes a lot of sense. I thank you for that.
I think what I heard too, Angela, as you were going through that example, is like a lot of agility, you know, this kind of fluid, agile type culture where we put something out, like a go-to-market, we'll call it for the sake of conversation. We learn about that go-to-market strategy, like how the customer, how the employee is reacting to it. We iterate on it because our goal too is to make improvements based on the feedback that we're receiving, because we are, of course, putting the human at the center of our philosophy or framework. Yeah. And while we're doing that, it doesn't mean that we also can't be building other parts of the car, you know, while we're making changes to the skateboard that, you know, we started with in the beginning. And so I love that piece of it, because I've worked in environments that are like that. And I think it does help get product or processes or systems like out in front of whoever you're wanting to get it out in front of sooner. And then the other thing that I love about it, which you kind of talked about at the beginning, and given that our audience is HR, I think everybody can resonate with this. But I've had two examples in my career where our organization has tried to build like a career framework. And they're massive projects. Like some people, like they can take years to put out like a really good career framework. And then there's this joke 3 years later when you're, you know, putting out your product, it's obsolete. You've got new roles in the company and you've got new structures and you've got new comp associated with the leveling. And it's like, you're going back through and it's almost like you're on this hamster that's on this wheel and the hamster never gets off the wheel because you're just always fixing it and building upon it. And so having something like that where you can, in a, using the career framework model again, get something out that's beneficial to the employees and the HR team and the comp team, et cetera, while you're continuing to build any additional pieces of the framework that are necessary.
Oh my gosh, I love that example so much. And it is on so many people's minds right now as well because of this, the shift to skills-based frameworks. And to your point, the way that roles shift over time and the way that people are moving between different jobs and companies and the way that capabilities are shifting, people are more able to move from even company to company because the skills that they're building are more transferable. Like the skills-based way of looking at career mobility is so much more human-centered than our, you know, sort of older models of career frameworks. I love that. That's a great example.
So I would love for you to share with our listeners a little bit about like how, you know, somebody is listening, they're like, oh, I'm resonating with this. I love this philosophy. I don't have anybody at my organization or that I know of that kind of has this background or experience. How could somebody kind of just get started, whether it be starting to get people to think about this new way of thinking or people that like project manager, thinking about like people that might have some of these just like general skills, because the other thing that we talked about is change management and there is some kind of overlap a little bit in just that change management philosophy. So people might have change management experts at their organization where they could tap them on the shoulder. So anyway, would love for you to just expand more on how somebody could kind of get started in this space.
Yeah, I love that. The best way to get started is to simply learn as much as you can and start practicing it. Those of us who know how to run the process learned it from working alongside someone else who was running it, or we weren't sure what to do and we brought in a partner to help us work through the process, or. There are lots of different options. But I think really square one, if you're not ready to run the process yet, is to just think about mindsets and how you start to shift organizational mindset into this way of thinking about experience before process, marketing rather than HR. There's no one size fits all. There shouldn't be like blanket approaches to the degree that we can avoid that. Some of those types of things. The other thing is, I think there are opportunities for every single HR professional to think about their opportunities to both operate a little bit more flexibly where they can in the ways that we've described, but also to help leaders to operate more flexibly. That's a really important part of this too. But, you know, there are many options out there for ways to research online. There are different courses that you can take. I have a consultancy called LiftBridge Strategy. And one of the things that we do is workshops for HR folks to guide them through the process. And we also do some human-centered strategy cohorts where we'll bring together groups of HR people and take them through kind of like a people-centered organizational assessment that we've developed to say, how do I really operationalize what being people-centered means? What are the behaviors of my HR team or my leaders or my company? And then to work through how do you guide teams through working more in those ways? And then, of course, we do things like partner with people through projects and lead projects and things like that. But just even getting exposure and starting to shift mindset is a huge part of it.
And who do you think needs to be a part of that stakeholder group? Is that starting with your leadership team first? Is it your peers? Does it really need to be a combination of both?
I think it's both a top-down and a bottom-up thing. I really do. I think that you can create movement in organizations when you have leaders who are open to thinking differently. One of the big things that I think is really important when people start to talk about bringing human-centered design to the picture is to help business leaders also understand how it benefits the business. How many times do we spend money on things? You referenced this earlier, right? Like, we spend money on a big expensive program, and then we find out maybe it wasn't the right thing. I remember once talking to an HR leader where they had spent, you know, their organization had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on a new recognition program, and no one had yet asked an employee what they thought about it. So even just taking the simple action of going and starting to ask employees can keep you from honestly wasting lots of money on programs that aren't really solving the root problem. So I think it's both leaders, and I think you need to have leaders who are open-minded to moving in new directions, but most leaders are looking for that these days anyway. So recently, this comes out every January, PwC does a CEO of surveys about their concerns for the upcoming year. And one of the big things that came out of this survey that I still just, and I'm surprised and not surprised based on all the things that we hear, is that CEOs believe that 40% of the time spent in their companies is inefficient and wasted. And when you look at the things that are on the list of time wasters, it's emails, meetings, procurement processes. I think those are maybe like the top three. And then somewhere down the line, but not too far off, are things like hiring processes, payroll processes, performance reviews. So I think if you look at what are you hearing from your leadership team about the pain that they feel related to HR processes. I don't think, unless you've already done a lot of work to make your HR or your performance review process super human-centered, at many companies, that's a common pain point where people just, it's not quite right. We want to do something different. It takes too much time. Start with a place where there's pain and apply a new way of thinking about it, because that's where you'll get leaders bought in. If they feel like things are inefficient, taking too much time, they're hearing a lot of noise about people not liking it, that's a place to apply a new process and a new way of thinking.
Yeah, I kind of, like, as you talked about that, I keep thinking about your car analogy because I really like it. And I feel like, to Jesse's point, do you need kind of top down or bottom up? In that scenario, I mean, depending on your leadership group, but top down might kind of be the car, right? And bottom up might be the skateboard in that scenario. I'm just thinking about oftentimes projects, like when Jesse, you talked about the, career path or. Yeah. Sometimes I feel like we over-engineer that so much because at some point we have to go up top to get certain approvals or like get their buy-in. And we feel like we have to have it completely baked in order to do that. So I'm just wondering if, kind of starting from the bottom to kind of gain advocates essentially, or to your point, kind of prove it out, Angela, if that's a better approach, or, I mean, obviously it depends on the company, but I'm just thinking people may be sitting there going, yeah, my leadership doesn't agree with the CEO survey you just mentioned. So how do I get their buy-in?
Yeah. The most powerful tools that I have used are either voice of the customer or voice of the employee. Or voice of the candidate, where you've gone and you've gathered the feedback. And when I talk about doing interviews, I don't mean going and saying, tell me about what you like and what you don't like. I mean going and saying, tell me about your best experience related to blah, blah, blah. Or tell me about your worst experience related to blah, blah, blah. You're looking for the outliers. And you're taking detailed notes and you are gathering quotes. And then you're taking those quotes that are inputs related to whatever it is that needs to change. And you're sharing those with leaders so that they have a window into what that experience looks like for, be it customers, team members, whatever. But I find the voice of the customer and voice of employee information, hearing it directly, maybe it's comments from a survey, right? Whatever it is, but hearing directly that voice about the experience can be really powerful. And then we know data doesn't lie. So what are you seeing? If there's a particular driver of turnover that you're seeing, or a driver of disengagement or, right? Like tying in data combined with those, you know, sort of qualitative pieces can really paint a picture of your why.
Yeah, those are great examples. You had mentioned a moment ago a little bit about your company, but as we're wrapping here, if you could share a little bit more about your organization, what you guys are all up to. I know that you recently launched a podcast, so welcome to the podcast world. And then maybe while you're sharing that information, Angela, also couple it with where people can get in touch with you, you know, any other kind of social media platforms that you're on.
Yeah, for sure. So I talked a little bit about LiftBridge strategy, which is really about people-centered business outcomes and applying all the things that we've been talking about today within the HR space primarily. And our website there is liftbridgestrategy.com. And surprise, you'll see some of the things that I've discussed on that website too. I'm sure that's shocking, right? But then we also have a human-centered leadership program called LeaderKind that is tied to LiftBridge. And then, yeah, you're right. We started a podcast over the summer, a good friend called The Heart of a Job, that is all geared towards providing some inspiration for people who are maybe feeling a little bit stuck in their career, or even just looking for a little inspiration on their morning commute, you know, anything works. And then we also just launched a new business called Mervy, which means mother life in French, that is a consultancy entirely focused on providing work-life harmony. And that's mervyconsulting.com. So yeah, and I'd love to connect on LinkedIn anytime anybody wants to reach out, happy to, but that's the high level. Lots going on here, but it's all rooted in this human-centered theme. It's all rooted in the human-centered theme and what people really want and need.
Yeah, I can feel that and hear that through the businesses that you're putting your time and energy behind. So I love your philosophy and what you're doing in this space. I hope the podcast takes off and does great in addition to both of your businesses, obviously. So thank you so much, Angela, for being a guest on the podcast. You'll have to keep us posted on some of these other businesses and your podcast, and maybe we can have you back on in the future to chat on a different topic.
Oh, that'd be fun. Thank you so much. What a fun conversation.